the story of Jacob and Laban's flocks here. Jacob's trying to want to kind of go his way, and of course, Laban's trying to stop him because he realizes that he's being blessed as a result of Jacob having been there. And before we really get into that story, you get a lot of this. There's almost two stories kind of taking place here. It's hard to kind of cover everything in one sermon. I'll do my best tonight to get through all of this. But the first thing we really see is this conflict that takes place between Leah and Rachel, the two wives of Jacob. And, you know, it just makes me kind of laugh because, you know, you hear people, you know, even Christians say, oh, yeah, the Bible, you know, is in support of polygamy. You'll see people ask questions like, hey, does the Bible teach polygamy? And then I've seen people where they answer, you know, so-called Christians say, yeah, I mean, think about, you know, all these guys in the Bible in the Old Testament that practice polygamy, where God, you know, explicitly says that a king should not multiply into himself wives, that he was against polygamy. I mean, from the beginning, he made the male and female, right, so that these twain should be one flesh. I mean, that's the way God's intention from the beginning, but man, being what he is, decided to go ahead and corrupt that marriage, that concept of being one man and one woman. But yet you have people say, oh, no, God's for it. God, you know, and, you know, there's Old Testament examples of polygamy. It's like, yeah, but have you ever actually gone to read the examples of the Old Testament where we have polygamy taking place? Have you actually gone to read those stories? Because it doesn't go very well, right? And this is a perfect example of that. Yeah, you know, Jacob, we saw last week, ended up with two wives, not through his own accord, but because he was tricked into having a second wife. And whether that's right or wrong, that's a whole other debate we can have. But, you know, he ends up with two wives, and, you know, there's a lot of conflict taking place here. There's a lot of, just tension here. And you can pick it up in the story, because you basically, in the story, you see where, the wives are competing for Jacob's affection, right? That he's being pulled in two different directions. And one of them, Rachel, the one that he loved, the one that he intended to marry, is favored. You know, she's the one that's being given the attention. She's the one that Jacob is spending the most time with, it appears. He's the one that he's dwelling with her, whereas Leah is kind of being left to herself, right? Which, you know, you feel bad for Leah in the story, because it seems to me like Leah is kind of left out in the cold a little bit, right? But it's interesting to me that God opens up her womb, right, and gives her children, okay? So let's just get into the story here a little bit. It says here in Genesis chapter 30, verse 1, and when Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister. So again, you can just see how great this whole polygamy thing is working out. And said unto Jacob, give me children, or else I die. Okay, so I'm just going to make several points as we go through the text tonight. The first thing I want to point out is that women naturally desire children. Okay, that's just a natural desire that they have. You know, they unless they've been brainwashed by the world, whether they adopted just, you know, this modernist, feminist, you know, ideology that's out there, where they're just more interested in a career and things like that. It's interesting to me how many times even women who in their early childbearing years, who forego having children, later in life regret not having them or start desiring children, you know, well, when they get into their late 30s, late 40s, you know, where it's kind of getting a little late at that point. You know, you're kind of, the biological clock, you know, is ticking down pretty quick when you're getting into your 40s, okay? But it just goes to show you that women naturally desire to have children. You know, whether they want to admit that or not, no matter how much they try to suppress that, that is there, right? I mean, you see Rachel, what's the problem here in the story? One woman's lady is having children, the other one isn't. And this is like a great source of envy. This is a source of conflict and strife. Leah is having these children, and Rachel's seeing it, and she's getting upset. And she's saying, you know, give me children or else I die, right? There's this one thing that she wants to do, and that's have children. She wants to have children. And Rachel and Leah, they kind of get into this competition here, right? Where they actually end up farming out, you know, their own handmaids even. So there's four women in this story that end up bearing the 12 children of Israel, right? And that's how, you say it's kind of an odd story, and it is, and I get it that it's another time and another place, but at the same time, you know, it kind of shows us, too, just this desire that women have to have children, so much so that they'll even have, you know, their handmaids bear the children. And in the story, Leah even brokers a deal here, right, with these mandrakes in hopes of conceiving, right? Because in verse 14, it says that Reuben went out in the days of the wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them unto his mother Leah, right? So Leah, of course, she had Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Then you had Bilhah, who ended up having Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, and Naphtali. Then you have Zilpah, the handmaid, who had Gad and Asher. Later on in the story, Leah bears again Issachar and Zebulun. And then we know the story that Rachel eventually bears Joseph. And then when they're returning back into the land, bears Benjamin. So Reuben is the firstborn, the first four that were born unto Leah, but the firstborn of all. And he goes out in the days of wheat harvest, and he finds these mandrakes. Now, I didn't take the time to look that up, what a mandrake is. I'm assuming it's some kind of... Does anyone know what a mandrake is? Has anyone seen a mandrake? You know, there's all these exotic fruits in the world that we've never even seen, right? You ever notice that? There's like other parts in the world where there's food items that none of us have even know about. Doesn't that kind of bother you? It keeps me up at night sometimes knowing that there's food in the world that I don't know about. Now, there's some food in the world I wish I didn't know about, right? I mean, some of these South Pacific cuisines, some of these Asian cuisines where things are writhing and there's like tentacles that are latching onto your face as you're trying to, like, that stuff I could forego. But knowing there's some kind of succulent fruit out there that I have never tasted, don't even know, maybe it's better that I don't know about it, right? But no one in here even knows what a mandrake is. I think it's some kind of a fruit, basically. Does anyone know? Anyone want to clue me in on this? Interactive preaching tonight. But nobody knows what a mandrake is, or they don't want to say, right? They think they're being tested, right? Okay. Well, whatever it is, you know, it's highly desirable, okay? Because Reuben goes out, he gets the mandrake, and he brings them unto his mother Leah. Then Rachel, she sees that, you know, these mandrakes have been found. And she says to Leah, give me, I pray thee, of thy son's mandrakes. So she wants some of these mandrakes. And she said unto her, is it a small thing that thou hast taken my husband? Would thou take away my son's mandrakes also? Right? She's like, you know, you already got my husband. You know, he was married to me first, Rachel. And now you want to steal the mandrakes. You want to steal the fruit, right? Sometimes all you've got in life is food, right? Food is always there for you. No matter what else is going on wrong in your life, food hasn't gone anywhere. Food has never failed you, right? Food is always good. Food is faithful, right? So that's kind of, you know, what she's kind of saying here, right? I don't know if that's what she's saying, but she's upset. She's like, you're taking everything else from me. Now you want these mandrakes too. What's the deal? And Rachel said, therefore he shall lie with thee tonight for thy son's mandrakes. So to not sound too crass, but I mean, this is kind of a weird situation where it's like, there, you know, basically Jacob's being kind of pimped out here for these mandrakes when you think about it. It's kind of a weird situation, right? She's like, oh, I really want these mandrakes. She's like, okay, well, how about a deal here? You know, well, I'll tell you what, he'll sleep in your bed tonight and I get some mandrakes out of the deal. Must have been some good mandrakes, I don't know. Then Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went to meet him and said, thou must come in unto me, for I have surely hired thee with my son's mandrakes. And he lay with her that night. Okay. So now, who here has ever, and you might, there's no, I'm not really sure whether what's right or wrong here, but who here has ever read this or has heard it inferred or said explicitly that these mandrakes somehow had something to do with fertility? Has anyone ever heard that? One other person? Okay, so I'm not alone on that. You know, I heard that, and every time I've always read the story, I've kind of thought that there's something, you know, about these, something potent about these mandrakes that have something to do with conceiving children. But then when you really think about the story, though, and maybe that is the case, you know, we have to rely on, like, you know, some commentary of some archaeologist from way back in the day who wants to tell us that mandrakes were, you know, these aphrodisiacs back in the ancient world or something like that. But even if that's the case, think about the story. Right? Leah is giving away mandrakes to have the husband. So if the mandrakes were what make you conceive, then she's kind of like, you know, you see what I'm saying? Like she's giving away the aphrodisiac and in order to have the husband. You need both, right? Wouldn't you think you need both? What are they going to do? What good are they going to do Rachel? She wants to have children. You know, and the way the story's been told and things people have said, you kind of get the impression that she wants the mandrakes so that she can have children. Right? But if she's giving away, you know, her husband, you know, that night, is that really going to help? Now maybe she gets him later. I get that. To me, I don't know. Where people kind of just lift things out of the Bible. They just kind of think, oh, yeah, this was some kind of aphrodisiac back in the day that helped you conceive children or something. But, you know, it's interesting, too, because apparently these mandrakes didn't work, right? Because Rachel doesn't have children until much later in the story. You know, so I don't know how long these mandrakes keep for, but, you know, I'd imagine they'd have rotted out by then. So anyway, it's just kind of a minor detail in the story, right? What's the deal with the mandrakes? You know, I just think that it was something that, you know, Rachel really wanted, and they just kind of made this deal. And the Bible is just kind of giving us these details to kind of show us that polygamy really, you know, God was right. Polygamy is not a good idea. It just creates tension. It creates, you know, just this really toxic environment. It just makes this really bad dynamic. Okay, puts people at odds. So it says there, and Jacob came out of the field. He lay with her that night. Verse 17, and God hearkened unto Leah, and she conceived and bare Jacob the fifth son. Right? And Leah said, God hath given me my hire because I have given. Now, when it says the fifth son there, it's actually the seventh son. Okay? But it's Leah's fifth, okay? Because she had Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Then Bilhah has Dan and Naphtali, right? Then you have Gad and Asher, okay? It's later than that even. Okay, so it's her sixth son, or her fifth son, excuse me. But it's not the fifth in the chronology of sons, if that makes sense. The sixth son. And Leah conceived again and bare Jacob the sixth son. So to me, I read the story, I don't think the mandrakes have anything to do with conceiving. Okay, I think she's using this to kind of contractually bind Jacob into getting what she wants. And what the other thing we can learn about the story is that God is the one that opens and shuts the womb. Okay, now this might not be something that people are dealing with tonight, but it very well may be something that people at some point in their life have to deal with. You know, I've known many people over the years that deal with infertility. People who desire to have children and for one reason or another are unable to. Okay. You know, the Bible's showing us in Genesis 30, verse 22, that God remembered Rachel and God hearkened to her and opened her womb, right? And even Jacob earlier on in the chapter says, you know, am I in God's place to open and shut the womb? He understands this is God's doing. And that's what we need to understand, that, you know, God is the one that opens and shuts the womb. That God, that the fruit of the womb is his reward, okay? And again, it's his reward. It's not his curse. It's not his burden. It's not his punishment. You know, having children is a blessing. Having children is a reward. Having children, yes, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of responsibility. But there's a lot of good things that come out of it. Right? For one, the human race doesn't go extinct, right? If one generation all agreeing to not have children, that would be it, right? And the command is to be fruitful and multiply. But again, the fruit of the womb is the Lord's reward. He's the one that gives children, okay? And so even if we want to say, oh, these mandrakes have something to do with fertility, well, you know, they're putting their trust in the wrong place. And, you know, there's no mention here that these mandrakes had any kind of a potent effect to where it actually helped children conceive. In the story, in the chapter, it's God that's remembering Rachel. It's God that's looking upon Leah. It's God that's opening the womb. Not these, you know, these mandrakes, not these man-made devices, not these old wives' tales that are bringing children about. It's the Lord that's giving children here. That ought to be a lesson for us today. You know, if we're, you know, if we are ourselves or anybody we know or at some point in our lives struggle with infertility, you know, we need to go to God. That's who's going to help us with this. And if you study the Bible, you'll see that when people pray and seek God, that God opens the womb. In every one of these instances where that it mentions, that God opens the womb, that God opens the womb, that he, you know, he answers that prayer. Okay? And, you know, sometimes I wonder if the reason why God doesn't always give the children that people desire. And I understand that, you know, there are things that people can do to themselves physically. That, I mean, we might do something to ourselves where we do make it impossible for us to have children. Okay, but I'm just saying in the natural course of things, when we're not, you know, doing things that might harm our body to prevent us from having children, whether intended or otherwise. In the natural course of things, you know, if people are struggling with infertility, you wonder if sometimes the reason why they are is maybe God's trying to get their attention. You know, one of the easiest ways for God to get our attention is to allow things to go wrong in our life. I mean, think about the times you've cried out to God and probably, you know, in a very earnest way. It's probably when you're going through something. It's probably when something bad was happening. That's just human nature. When things are good, and this is what Moses was warning them when they, you know, Deuteronomy, when they're going, that they would not forget the Lord their God. When they go into land, they prosper and they dwell in vineyards or homes that they did not build, and they eat of vineyards that they did not plant. When God just blesses them immensely, that they would forget the Lord their God. Because that's human nature. When things are going well, when we have all this prosperity, you know, that's when we kind of forget about God. God takes a back seat. You know, and sometimes God lets things get lean. Sometimes God lets us go through difficult things. Sometimes God lets us go through trials, tribulations, so that we would seek Him, right? And that's, you know, that's a good thing, you know, because the God, you know, a broken and contrite spirit, God will not refuse or despise. And, you know, if we're going through something, if we're having difficulty, you know, maybe it's just God trying to get our attention. Say, hey, you know, let's work on some stuff, right? You know, that might be the case sometimes even in infertility, right? Rachel eventually bears children. Years later, the mandrakes are long gone, you know, whether they had anything to do with it anyway. And maybe somewhere along the line, Rachel realizes, you know, it's God. Like, it's like my husband said, God is the one that's in the place of opening and shutting the womb. Okay. So there's a couple things we can learn from this first part of the chapter here is that, you know, one, women desire children. That's a God-given instinct to have children. It takes, you know, a bunch of, you know, it takes a lot of institutions, it takes a lot of brainwashing to kind of convince them otherwise, you know, try to make them think contrary to their own nature. But, you know, that's something that's just ingrained in every woman to have children, okay? And the other thing we can see from this also is that God's the one that opens and shuts the womb. And lastly, not that it's a big problem here, you know, outside of maybe some parts of Utah and northern Arizona, we don't have, you know, polygamy is not good. Polygamy is a hurtful thing, right? Think about how Leah is very lonely here, right? Kind of put yourself in her shoes, right? She's the rightful wife, and she's kind of being denied here, right? She has to literally hire her own husband to have that relationship with him. That's kind of sad when you think about it. Look at verse 20 of Genesis 30. And Leah said, God hath endued me with a good dowry. Now will my husband dwell with me, because I have borne him 6 sons, and he called his name Zebulun. Right? So she's trying, you can get the sense that, you know, now my husband's going to love me. Now he's going to want to dwell with me, because I'm the one that's bearing the bulk of the children here, right? She's the one that's had half of the tribes, right? She's the one that's born the most children unto him. So she, and that statement just kind of smacks with sadness when you think about it. Now will my husband dwell with me? I mean, well, what's been wrong up until this point? Well, the problem is that Jacob never really loved her, that he was in love with Rachel, and he got into this polygamous situation. And, you know, this is something that husbands need to be careful, not polygamy necessarily, but the other application you can make is not becoming bitter against your wives, not despising your wives. You know, we as husbands need to dwell with our wives. It's important. And not to, you know, just treat them like, you know, they're just another, you know, just thing in our life or something, or just another part of our life. You know, our wives are incredibly important. You know, and they have needs, they have to be met, they have time needs to be spent with them. And the Bible in 1 Peter explicitly says this. Okay? It says in verse 7, likewise ye husbands, dwell with them, wives, according to knowledge. Right? That's what Leah wanted, that her husband would dwell with her. And then in 1 Peter he's saying, husbands, dwell with your wives according to knowledge. We should spend time with our wives. And I know that sounds like, yeah, obvious, right? But, you know, there's a lot of guys out there. I mean, we're reading about Jacob. He's not, I mean, Leah has to go to all these great lengths to try and get some time with her husband. You know, it's out there. People ignore their wives. They don't spend time with their wives. And it's a shame, right? We need to dwell according to, or with our wives according to knowledge. We need to give honor unto the wife as unto the weaker vessel. We should be looking to help our wives, assist our wives. You know, obviously, you know, we provide, we pay the bills, we do all that stuff. But that's just kind of our responsibility. That's what we're supposed to do, right? And we can't just get this attitude, well, you know, I paid the bills, good enough, right? That's where it ends, you know. We have to make sure that we're, you know, spending time with them, helping them, giving honor to them, and so on and so forth. Now, let me get a little bit, and this might make people a little uncomfortable to talk about from the pulpit, but the Bible addresses it, so I'm going to address it, okay? Physical relations should not be denied from spouses, okay? And that needs to be said. That is one way to destroy your marriage very quickly. When you start using that physical relationship as some kind of a carrot on a stick or a reward or to manipulate people to get what you want, it's not right, okay? Go to 1 Corinthians 7. It's important that we read this. Look, the Bible addresses it, so I'm going to talk about it, right? Isn't that what's going on in the story tonight? It's all revolving around the physical relationship between man and wife, man and wives in Jacob's case, right? And you see these two ladies that they desperately want to have children. They want to bear children. Well, they need their husband for that. And it seems like, you know, Leah is being ignored in this area to where she has to, you know, use these mandrakes to bribe her own husband so that she can have children and have this physical relationship and to have time with her husband. And the physical relationships are not to be denied spouses, whether it's wife denying husband or husband denying wife. It says in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 3, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. And that's the Bible's, you know, tasteful, gentle way of talking about that, rendering due benevolence. It's talking about the physical relationship, the act of intimacy between husband and wife, between man and woman. And likewise, also the wife unto the husband. It goes both ways, right? The wife hath not power over her own body, but the husband. Ha ha ha. Right? All the guys are like, yeah. Glad I came to church tonight, right? But wait a minute. And likewise, also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. So if the wife has that need, expresses that, it's the husband's duty and job to fulfill that need, whether he feels like it or not. And vice versa. Okay? If the husband has that need, as men often do, you know, it's the wife's responsibility to, you know, deliver that to her, to him. Because her body is not her own and his body is not his own. That's what the Bible just said. And now, if you think that's talking about something else, come talk to me after the sermon. I would love to know. But I think it's explicitly clear. It's very well understood. It's been preached many, many thousands of times. That's exactly what this is talking about. Verse 5, defraud not ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time, they may bring yourselves, give yourselves to fasting and to prayer and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency, right? Your inability to contain yourself. That's what it means to be incontinent, right? To not withhold, not to be able to exercise self-control, right, in this area. And if that's what he's saying here, is like if this relationship is not taking place between husband and wife, you're leaving the door open for temptation to seek to fulfill those desires through other means. And worst of all, obviously, being adultery. Going out and committing adultery, you know, that's a punishment that in the Old Testament was punishable by death. Okay. So he's saying here, look, you know, unless it's for a time, right? Unless you agree together, like, hey, we're going to not have this union for a time that we may give ourselves to prayer and fasting. So, you know, some people ask, well, how often should that be? Like, how often should people, husbands and wives, get together like that? Well, first of all, that's kind of a personal question, right? And people are different, okay? And, you know, people, as they go through life, you know, that desire waxes and wanes and grows strong in our time. You know, there's seasons to all that. I get that. But how about just as a general guideline, ask yourself this: how long would you go without eating? Now, if you're anything like me, it's not long. 3-4 hours, you know, aside from the time you're sleeping, you know, right? It's like a daily thing, right? That's probably a good principle right there. I wouldn't go any longer without that relationship than I would not eating. I think the longest, I don't even remember exactly, but if you've ever done any kind of fasting, you know, you can go several days. You know, but that's pretty extreme, isn't it? If you ever fasted for 7 or 8 days, 9 days, that's a long time. When you find yourself just like smelling food, just standing over a plate of food, just like wafting it in your nose, like, right? Has anyone ever experienced this? I remember I did a fast once. It was just like my wife was cooking, and this was for physical reasons, okay? So this is for weight loss reasons and other reasons. So I didn't just lose my reward just now, okay? But she'd be cooking for the kids, because obviously I'm the only one fasting, and I would come in the kitchen when she's cooking, and I would just stand over the plate, and whatever she's cooking, I'd just smell it. Oh, but isn't that a perfect picture of what happens when you go without some physical need? You know, to the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet, but the full soul loatheth an honeycomb. You know, the guy that's full isn't going to be tempted by other things. You know, if I'm, you know, eating a good meal tonight, as I did, you know, ate a nice pork chop and some rice, you know, I'm not going to be tempted on the way home to, you know, jerk the wheel into Arby's down the road here or Taco Bell, right? Now, if it's Cane's, it's another... No, I'm just kidding. Right? But I'm going to be able to go home and, you know, have a light snack and go to bed. Why? Because that need has been met. Right? It's a great analogy. It's a great picture. You know, and that's a very... You know, say hunger is a very real need. Yeah, well, so is the need for a physical relationship. That's a God-given desire that's just put into us. And it needs to be met within the bounds of marriage. I mean, that's one of the major, it's one of the main reasons to get married. And that, you know, that's not a carnal thing to say. That's the truth. You know, it's better to marry than to burn, the Bible says. You know, if we're burning with our lust, if we're struggling in that area, you know, we should get serious about finding a spouse. Make it, you know, mission priority number one. To go find that spouse and have that need met, because you'll end up resorting to other things. You'll find yourself in Jack in the Box. Blech, right? I mean, you get hungry enough. Even I've eaten a Jack in the Box once years ago. We didn't have it where I'm from. We moved to Phoenix, and someone's like, "Oh, you got to get the 99-cent tacos or something like that." Couldn't even finish it. It's disgusting. It's the worst. It's like, who eats that stuff? Jack in the Box. Yeah. I call it something else. I won't say that from the pulpit. Ask me later, right? But, you know, it's the same analogy. You know, if that relationship isn't there between man and wife, that full physical needs aren't met, you know, the husband or the wife is going to start, you know, looking at the drive-thru at work. You know, that office worker that they didn't care for, all of a sudden, when things are going bad at home, when there's tension at home, when there's resentment and bitterness and anger and envy and people are holding out on each other and denying each other, you know, it's not going to go away. They're going to start looking elsewhere. And next thing you know, they're going to be in the bosom of a stranger, as the Bible says. So it's a serious issue. I mean, why else would the Bible take the time to address this in 1 Corinthians? Why else would Paul take the time to write about something like this unless it was a major issue? When the Bible addresses it, it's important. And he's spending several verses here on this, right? And he's warning us. He's saying, look, if you do this, if you deny each other, don't go too long, because you'll be tempted. And you'll be tempted by Satan, right? Let Satan tempt you for your incontinency. So, you know, that, and that's what we see taking place in the story tonight. You say, where did that come from? Well, Leah's being denied. You know, at least enough so to where she feels like she has to, you know, take her mandrakes and hire her own husband to come in unto her. That's what she said. I have hired thee tonight. That's a sad thing. And when we think about, you know, that specific situation with Jacob and, you know, being married to Leah, a woman that he, you know, was tricked into marrying by her father, as we read last week, if you know the story, and also being married to Rachel, the person for whom he labored for 7 years, and it says that those 7 years, what seemed a few days unto him, for the love wherewith he had her. So he's married to a woman that he loves very deeply, but then he's also married to a woman that he's not in love with, right? And this should be another lesson to us, that we should marry for love and love alone. And that's not me just being up here being a hopeless romantic, okay? People should marry people that they genuinely and sincerely love. Because that's who you're going to want to spend your time with, right? You end up married to a Leah, that you, someone you don't love. And I don't think that Leah was an unlovable person. There's nothing in there that says she was bad or a bad person. She was just, you know, he not attractive. He wasn't attracted to her, whatever. It's not who we wanted, right? Whatever. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I get it, okay? But if we're married to somebody that we don't love, you know, we're not going to treat them the way we should. It's just a fact. You know, sometimes my wife will get after me a little bit because I kind of, when she started coming around, and you know, I kind of played hard to get, if you can believe it. And I didn't even have a lot of options, in fact. You know, but that was a part of the reason why. Because I wanted to make sure I wasn't just marrying somebody for their principles. I wasn't just going to marry somebody because we both believe the Bible. Now look, you should marry somebody that believes the Bible. I'll say that again. You should marry somebody that believes the Bible. That's a good place to pipe up and say amen right there, guys. Because that's important. Be not unequally yoked with unbelievers. Okay? I don't care how good-looking she is, how good-looking he is. If they don't believe the Bible, if they don't love God, you should go running and screaming in the other direction. Unless you don't love God or you don't believe the Bible, then maybe you two are. Maybe it's a match made in hell. I don't know. Right? But you should, you know, marry people not just for their principles. Yeah, great. She's saved. She's a Christian. She's in church 3 times a week. She's got the standard. She believes all the right things about, you know, childbearing and staying home. She believes it. She's going to practice it. She's sincere. Great. Do you love her? Well, I mean, I think she's cute. You know, my pastor, before he married us, I remember he took me in the office and he sat me down and said, can you live without her? And of course, I could live without her, but I didn't want to. Right? It's not like I was going to, you know, it's not like, lest I die. You know what I mean? Like, obviously, yeah, life's going to go on, but I didn't like the idea of life without her. And he kind of asked me that because he wanted to make sure, hey, do you really love this person? You know, and that's advice I've given other people. If you can live without them, do it. Because you might find yourself wishing you had at some point. If you marry the wrong person, it's true. Look, there's people that get married and they end up hating each other. They end up hating each other more than they hate anybody else on the planet. It happens all the time, folks. Marriage is a serious thing. It's important and it should not be taken lightly. Okay? It's a very important relationship. It's the most important relationship you're going to have outside of Christ. Okay? Your relationship with God is a relationship with your spouse. So make sure you go about it correctly. Marry for love. Okay? Great. She checks all the boxes. Great. He checks all the boxes. Great. Do you love them? Are you going to be able to look that person in the face for the rest of your life? Do they get you, right? That's how I knew. My sister told me one time, she's like, you got to find somebody who can handle how weird you are. And then my wife came along, right? And I knew her older brother for like years before. I didn't even know it was her brother. It's like, oh, that's your brother? And we got along. And, you know, it made sense, right? I was like, he's kind of weird. I'm kind of weird. You know, the humor was there, right? It was a good fit, right? You know, great, they check the boxes. Great, they're in church. Great, they're saved. Great, they're new IFB, independent, fundamental, soul-winning, fire. They hate the fag, all this stuff. You know, they're just blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but do you love them? Can you stand being around them? Can you see yourself spending the rest of your life with that person? That's a, you know, you got to ask. That's what you're signing up for in marriage. Okay, because divorce is not an option. And if you think it is, don't get married, because that's probably what will happen. The first sign of struggle, the first time things get rough, the first time, you know, you think you married the wrong person, you're out, you're gone, or they are. So take it seriously. Marry somebody you love. Look at the story tonight. What else do you want me to preach tonight? I mean, what else am I supposed to preach out of the story? That's what's going on. Leah's, you know, being ignored. Leah's having to hire her own husband. She's the first wife. You know, she seems like, you know, that's where it should have ended. You got tricked, tough, you know. Maybe you should have talked to her on the honeymoon. I don't know. It's like, you know, that part of the story boggles my mind. It's like, how does he not find out till the morning? You know, thank God for indoor lighting, I guess. You know? But, you know, that's what's happened, you know. That's who you're stuck with. Oh, just have another wife. You know, and then someone gets ignored. You marry the person you don't love. You marry the person, not a bad person, but you don't want to be around them. Maybe they check all the boxes, but your personalities don't mesh well. It's going to be a long life. So take it seriously. And don't get tricked into marriage like Jacob did. Don't let other people trick you into marriage. I know people like this. Their pastors would come to them and say, oh, it's God's will for you two to get married. Can't you see it? Divorce today. Those same two people. Because they just listened to somebody else. Oh, my pastor said it was God's will for me to marry that person. And then they're both going, why did God let us get married? We hate each other. Because you let somebody else tell you, you know, what God's will is for you. And, you know, that's another thing that's a whole other sermon right there. You know, people get so worked up about God's will, like there's one specific person you must marry. You know the problem with that is like, what if you get convinced later that you married, that you missed out on God's will there, like you got it wrong? Then things get weird. Trust me, I can tell you stories where people are like, well, it was never God's will for me to get married to this person. So maybe I should just get divorced and go get married to another person. Or maybe it's okay for me to go commit adultery on that person. Right? Don't fall for this whole thing about, oh, there's only one specific, your soulmate. It's a bunch of hogwash, okay? Are you a man? Are you a woman? Okay, it's going to work, okay? Believe me, physically you're compatible. You know, don't fall for this other thing. Well, I gotta try the milk before I buy the cow. Right? No, that's wrong. Milk's milk, my friend. Okay? I get some of it's 2%, some of it's whole milk, but whatever. Okay? Milk's milk. Well, I got to see if we're physically compatible. You'll figure that out on your wedding night pretty quick that you are. Okay? See if you're compatible, you know, as a person, you know, personality-wise. Right? Marry for love. Make sure, yeah, they check all the boxes, great. You know, and hopefully this person will be thinking the same thing. Whoever it is you're going to marry, they're going to marry for love. So maybe that would, you know, cause you to be a more lovable person, right? That's how that would work. Don't get tricked into marriage by others. It doesn't matter how well they're going to fit in with the family. It doesn't matter how well the family likes them. Because here's news for you. When you get married, it's a new family. You're your own family now. I mean, it's great when in-laws can get along. You know, I've got a great mother-in-law. Love her. Wasn't as good as my wife's mother-in-law. You guys can think about that. Get back to me later, right? Because that's my mother, okay? Wouldn't want to disrespect her, right? But, you know, it's great when in-laws are like, is that like a necessity? Well, the in-laws have to get along. Says who? What does it matter? It's great if it works out that way. But, you know, what you'd be more concerned is like, do you actually love this person? Do you want to spend the rest of your life with this person? Does the idea of not having them in your life, does that bother you? Or does that something you can be like, oh, I'm okay with that. Then that's probably not the person for you. So, you know, that's, I'm just preaching through the chapter tonight, folks. I mean, there's so much here. It's so many, you know, we just read these little facts about these stories, but there's so much going on with the dynamics there. With Leah and Rachel and Jacob and the whole situation, how everything, and there's things that we can learn from this. Then, of course, you know, the latter half of the story is where you have the whole thing playing out with Laban, his father-in-law. I don't know if we're going to have time to get through all of it tonight. Let's try to get through it quickly, though, because I don't think there's a whole lot. I think we all know the story here. But basically, you know, after Rachel has Joseph, then it comes to pass, verse 25, that Jacob says unto Laban, his father-in-law, send me away, give me that I may go into my own place, into my own country. Just ties in right with the point I just got done making, that in-laws are an afterthought when it comes to your marriage. Okay? He's like, because he's going to go do his own thing, right? He's going to go live and start his own family and go be his own thing. He doesn't have to have Laban constantly in the picture. Give me my wives and my children, for I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service which I have done unto thee. And Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. So Jacob's saying, let me go. I want to take what's mine and leave. And Laban's saying, no, 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 don't go. I need you to stay here, because you being here has made me incredibly wealthy, right? I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake, right? And what we can learn from this is that it pays to be a profitable employee, right? Because that's what Jacob is, okay? And he gets into it next week. He explains all the stuff he put up with all these years that he's been serving Laban. But he's been faithful, he's been steady, God's been blessing him. Laban recognizes it, and he doesn't want to lose him. Is he worried about him taking his two daughters away and his grandchildren? No, Laban wants him to stay because he wants the sheep to, and the goats and the herds to continue to grow. That's what he's got. He sees Jacob, he's just cha-ching, 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 cha-ching. He's just hearing the register. That's what's going on here. Which, you know, tells you a little bit about Laban, okay? But, you know, it's also, the lesson we can learn is, if you don't want to be somebody that's let go at work, then you better be somebody that's worth keeping around. Right? Because things get lean, right? Things, you know, economy shrinks, people start getting laid off. You know, they sit, you know, the higher-ups sit down with a list of names, and it's no longer whoever has a pulse that can stay. It's like, who's actually bringing something to the company? Who's actually contributing to the profitability of this company? Who can we not afford to let go or lose? You know, not everyone makes that list. The guy that just, you know, is late to work, last one there, first one to leave, complains when he's there, you know, takes long breaks, you know, doesn't get anything done, is constantly making mistakes, backtalks his supervisor, talks smack about, you know, the boss behind his back. That's the guy that's like, all right, well, we don't need him, because we can find, you know, some jerk with the pulse anytime. There's a line around the block, and when things get better, then we'll go find another one of those. But we need the guy that's diligent, the guy that puts up with things, the guy that works hard, the guy that's out there, as Jacob goes on and explains in the next chapter, in the frost, in the heat, in the day, in the night, working hard, being diligent, right? That's who you want to be. You know, and you'll get a sense of that, how important that is when you're married and have kids. Just trust me, it's important, okay? And he wants him to stay because he wants the blessing to continue. And, of course, they had this argument where he says, you know, appoint me my wages and I will give it. And he said, thou knowest I have served thee, how thy cattle was with me. And he's just asking him to be let go, to be able to go and do his thing. But, you know, I'll probably have to finish the rest of this up on Sunday night just because there's just too much here. I don't want to just gloss over that. I think this is like a whole nother lesson that we can learn out of the story. But it was important to take the time to talk about this dynamic in the beginning. Now, maybe you're a single guy here, a single girl, and, you know, this isn't making, you know, You say, what do I get out of this? Well, like, hopefully you don't stay like that forever. You know, one day, hopefully, you're going to find somebody that can actually put up with you, right? Like I did, you know, who can handle how weird you are, as it was told me, right? And, you know, you'll know what to look for in that person, right? You'll find somebody that you love, someone you want to be with, and then you'll learn some things tonight about what it takes to make a marriage work. You know, a little, and I know we didn't go into great depth, but, you know, we covered a couple things. Men need to dwell with their wives, not just treat them like they're, you know, just another burden to be born, that they're just another, you know, responsibility in life. You know, they're supposed to be our companions, our friends. You know, it's great to have that in your life. And, of course, marriage is where that physical relationship is supposed to be met, and we should never withhold that from our spouses, because that creates all kinds of problems that you don't want to deal with, okay? And, you know, when you get married, make sure you marry for love. Marry someone that you want to be with. And that's, you know, that's the number one thing. But, you know, as we got into a little bit too, you know, when it comes to being a hard worker, you know, that's what's going to make you valuable. Let's go ahead and close in a word of prayer.